It's very difficult being a senior monk. Many senior monks, like the Buddha, had Sariputra and Moggallana on either side of him. All I've got is two teddy bears. But they're very nice. Which one? I don't know which one's Sariputra, which one's Moggallana. There's two here. But anyway, this is the first morning of our meditation retreat. And it is a meditation retreat, so we focus on the meditation. And I remember one of the questions somebody asked me some time ago, that when I meditate, what do I actually meditate on? And it was an interesting question, because I never really noticed the different things which I watch when I meditate. I just noticed just how it gets more and more peaceful. The object of meditation will always change as you get deeper and deeper into meditation. And that's what's supposed to happen. It's just like the simile I give, that those people have come from overseas. You know, you get on an aircraft and you get to, say, Singapore, and from Singapore you change the plane and you get to Perth. But you cannot land your aircraft in Bodhinyana Monastery. We don't have a landing strip. So you have to get out of your plane and start walking, and then you get a taxi or you get a car or a train or something to get to Jhana Grove. And when you get to Jhana Grove, you can't drive the car into your cottage. You go as close as you can, and then you start walking. And this is, we use different vehicles suitable for different stages in your journey. In this particular case, the journey from your home over to Perth. And each one of those different vehicles are suitable for the different terrain. And it's something which I remember reading in the Samanyapala Sutta. That was where the king Ajatasattu went to see the Buddha. And then they said he went in a chariot as far as a chariot could go. Then he got down from the chariot and walked in his shoes as far as he could go in his shoes. Then he took the shoes off and went barefoot into the hall. Each part of our journey always needs different types of vehicles. And in this particular case, in meditation, we also need different vehicles. But I'm just recognizing, just maybe it's not just habit, but you can feel just how peaceful you are, how aware you are, how content you are in your meditation. And that is probably more than anything else what I focus on, the stillness and the peace and the joy as well. Because with the joy comes the clarity of mindfulness. Honestly, that if you haven't got that energy, that oomph and that happiness inside, the mindfulness is always not powerful enough yet. Strong mindfulness always comes with strong happiness, with piti sukha, as the Buddha said. So this is one of the reasons why these are little landmarks which I kind of look out for. And that's, you know, how I've learned to meditate over all these years. But I also know that if I rush the process because I want to try and control it, try and make it happen as fast as I possibly can, if ever I try and control the process, I always delay it. It's just one of those things you've heard me say for so many years. Every time I take a shortcut, it always takes a longer time. So many times that has happened. So instead of doing the shortcuts, you just do the usual way of, first of all, you establish mindfulness and relax the body. And it's something which I noticed when I was, first of all, practicing Anapanasati. Yeah, it seems so easy. I mean, what can be more easy than just watching a breath go in and go out? You're always breathing. So it means that you've got something to watch. It's always there. Why is it you can't always continue watching your breathing? What's the problem? And of course, that for many times I thought, I need to put more effort in, to strive more. There's the breath, I can see it at the beginning, and I really focus on it. And of course, you've heard me say so many times that that doesn't work. If you try to watch the breath, after a little while, it vanishes, it disappears. And it's not because you've got into a deep meditation, it's because you're either falling asleep or you're restless. And it was something I kind of contemplated. Why is it so difficult to watch the breath? Such a simple thing. You all know what the breath is. Why can't you just watch it? Even for people who've never meditated before, I just ask them, sit down, make yourself reasonably comfortable, and just watch three breaths. In, out, in, out, in, out. It's very simple. Even little kids never meditated before in their life can do that. So why is it so difficult for people who've been Buddhists for years to watch their breath? First of all, when I tell that to children, I never tell them how to watch the breath, where to watch the breath, how long to make the breath, how short to make the breath. Just keep it simple. Just watch your breathing. And of course, there's no trouble at all for them. So after they've done three breaths, and I say, close your eyes, and now watch 1,000 breaths. Should be just as easy. Why is it that, say, 1,000 breaths, and people start thinking and wondering, and they say they can't do it? There's a psychological barrier there. And the psychological barrier is, when it's just watching your breath, three breaths, it's something really easy, you can do it, you know you can do it. You don't tell you how to do it, you just do it. It's something simple. Sometimes I think I give too many instructions, but if I didn't give any instructions at all, there'd be nothing to talk about in the morning and no questions in the evening. But nevertheless, you talk and you say the reason is because when people start watching the breath, if you're going to be watching so a lot of breaths continuously, one after the other, you do need a lot of not just mindfulness, but contentment. As we chanted this morning, for those of you who are here, I know some people are doing their own chanting in their rooms this morning. That's fine, there's nothing wrong with that the first day, for goodness sake. But during the chanting of the Metta Sutta, to be content and easily satisfied. That's what the words we use here. And they are powerful words. Sometimes we chant these words, and because you can understand them, you think they're not really profound. Content and easily satisfied, yeah, sure. Have a contemplate about that. To be content and easily satisfied. You're not going to ask for enlightenment or jhanas or nimittas or great insights or being able to fly through the air or read other people's minds. You're just content, happy to be here. Not asking for anything, not wanting anything, not striving for anything. Just being here, content and easily satisfied. Just a little bit of peace in your mind. Even just half a bit of peace, not much. How wonderful, you get so content and happy with little. And that does mean that you're understanding that sutta there, that chant which we do in the morning, the Karanimata Sutta. To be content, easily satisfied. Can you do that? Can you do that and think, this is good enough, just being here in Jhana Grove. I'm not going to ask for anything, I'm not going to develop my meditation, I'm just happy to be here, that's enough. Well, I've got on this retreat, yes. I don't want anything more. If you could really do that, I mean really do that, you're getting jhanas by yesterday or something. Simply because you have the source, the cause of stillness. When you want something, you disturb your mind. Even wanting good things, you disturb your mind. So learning how to be content. And the only place you can be content is in this moment. You can't be content in the future. That's craving, that's desire, that's discontent with where you are now. Be content right now with how you feel, who you are, what's going on. And then that allows mindfulness to start to establish itself. Often, you know, you ask, what actually is mindfulness? I'm not going to follow some definitions by psychologists who don't know what deep meditation is. But you know, what actually is mindfulness? Based on how the Buddha taught, but also based on experience. I mean, for about 55 years meditating. What actually is that mindfulness? It is a clear awareness of what's happening right now. You cannot be mindful of the future. That shows you've lost your mindfulness. When you want to get somewhere, when you're afraid of what's going to happen next, or when you're lingering in the past, oh, this is terrible, I've heard this story before, or just I want this other story, or I had too much for breakfast, or why did that person bang the door this morning so I woke up hurting and I'm sleepy now. All that stuff from the past and the future, that's, you're not really being mindful right now. So one of the first things we do in our meditation is establish that mindfulness. And it's not just being in this moment. Being in this moment was not invented by Eckhart Tolle. Just see the Bhaddhikaratta Suttas, 2,500 years before Eckhart Tolle. The problem is with Buddhists, we never get a patent for anything. We don't teach and just sue people who take our metaphors or teachings and make money out of them. That's not our way. We want to share it as wide and broad as anybody does. But that present moment awareness was from the very early part of Buddhism. It was a part of meditation. You have to get into this present moment. Actually, you don't have to, but you do, because it's natural. It's not what you have to do, but what actually has to happen. So this present moment awareness, you can only be mindful in this moment. Anything about your past, it's not mindful. You find that what you think happened is not what actually happened. What did you have for breakfast this morning? How much? Where did you sit? This is an old meditation trick. Your shoes, your sandals, where did you leave them before you came in here? Was it on the left or the right, in the front or the back? A lot of times you don't know. I know where I left my sandals because I didn't wear them. Just walk straight in here. So, but anyhow, it's amazing just how unreliable the memory of the past actually is. And for that reason, you can't actually trust the past. And if the past is unreliable, what about your future? Oh my goodness, the amount of things I thought would happen, and they never happened. You know, when I was at school, my worst subject at school was English. And if my English teacher could see me now, giving talks to thousands of people, writing so many books, I've got so many lifetimes as a donkey to look forward to. it's impossible. But nevertheless, you know, that's what happens. The future is always a series of totally unexpected events. And because of that, it's a waste of time thinking about it or planning it. I always say this, and a lot of this is true. I hardly ever planned for the future. Because I notice when I don't plan for the future, when I'm kind of being irresponsible, then many things go wrong. But when I do plan for the future, they go wrong anyway. So I enjoy the peace and quiet, knowing it's going to go wrong either way. It's much more fun. And people don't mind it going wrong when I tell them it's a new adventure, a new way of looking at things, a new way of doing things. But certainly with the meditation, when you start meditating, I don't know what's going to happen. I just meditate, be here right now as best I can. Get that mindfulness strong in the beginning. Once that mindfulness is established, and see, well, what the heck's going on? Once you're aware, you can find out what's happening. How on earth can you meditate when you don't know what's going on? So you're aware of what's going on. I usually start with my body. As I mentioned yesterday, you're aware of how your body feels. Now, when you're aware of your body again and again and again and again and again and again and again, you get sensitive to your body. There was this story of, and I haven't said it for a while, I thought I knew the monk who had generated this story, but he says it wasn't him, but I don't know who it was. But there was one monk in Bodhinyana Monastery many, many years ago, and whenever he meditated and sat down on the ground, crossed his legs, no matter so how many cushions or what posture he did, he always developed a very painful back, a very sore back. And it was so painful that, you know, it was really disturbing his meditation. So, of course, what you do, don't try and use psychic powers or use loving kindness or use all these other things, first of all. First thing you should go and do is see a doctor. And that came from, you know, even when I was a young monk in Thailand. There was one of my friends, he had an ordinary mosquito bite. He scratched the bite, it got infected, and his whole arm blew up. We had all these amazing therapies, you know, they're not the usual therapies, like garlic poultices, other leaves and things from the forest. And he put it on his arm for days, and my good, I sat next to him. He really stank, you know, with the garlic poultice on his arm, and nothing worked. He tried this and tried that, tried massaging it. Every weird therapy people remembered, he tried, and nothing worked. Until somebody decided, well, you know, we've got some penicillin in the medicine cabinet, just have a penicillin tablet. He took that, within an hour, it was gone. You know, so, sometimes it's nice to be innovative, but try the easy options first. You know, so a lot of times, you know, the easy option to be able to be aware or to, you know, to have a body which is not, you know, really painful. He went to see the doctor. So when he went to see the doctor took some scan of his back and he came back with the news, "I'm terribly sorry, but you've got some congenital deformity in your spine. We can't give you an operation. You probably won't be able to walk after the operation. There's nothing we can do. You just have to don't meditate." Imagine that, you know, you're a monk and if somebody says, "No, you can't meditate anymore." That's like telling a Singaporean you can't eat. That's not fair. So, actually, telling anyone they can't eat. Like telling a Sri Lankan that you can't sort of have tea. Or telling me I can't have tin kiri. Tin kiri, by the way, that's strong Sri Lankan tea with condensed milk. It's a national dish. Isn't it? Yeah, okay. Anyway, so what he did, he got this book, and it's, the reason I mentioned this book, it was a simple book on how to heal your own back, written by a New Zealand genius. And all he said was just to know that on either side of your spine, there are muscles which you are totally unaware of. We've all got those muscles. So how can you become aware of them? He said a simple practice. With your hand, you know, had a picture of where they are, stroke that area. 15 minutes either side every morning. And that's what he did for about 3 months. And after 3 months of stroking 15 minutes either side, he could feel those muscles without even needing to touch them. He had created the neural connection, as we would say in science, so you could experience a feeling in those muscles. Now, once you can experience a feeling in those muscles, now, by trial and error, try extending them and then releasing them. In other words, exercise them. And it took him a few days to be able to move those muscles. Once he could experience them, now he could actually try and move them this way and that way, just by an act of will. And so he could exercise those muscles. And 15 minutes every morning, he exercised the muscles on one side and 15 minutes on the other side every morning. And those muscles soon became so strong, much stronger than those same muscles in my back and your back. They became so strong that it totally compensated for the weakness in his spine. And the problem was solved. It's a great example of what mindfulness is, how important it is, but not just being aware. And once you see the problem, it gives you more options of what to do and how to solve the problems. It's one of my cheeky examples about mindfulness. Once upon a time, there was this wealthy woman, lived in a mansion by herself, And one day she decided to go to the temple to listen to a talk and do some meditation. She did have a guard at the door of her house because she was wealthy. So she told the guard, "I'm going to the Buddhist temple this evening to do some meditation and to listen to a talk. Now, you know about mindfulness too. That's why I hired you. You're the guard. Please be mindful. There's lots of robbers in this district. And when they realize that there's no one at home, my house could be robbed. So please, guard, be mindful." And he said, "Yes, certainly, I will be very mindful. I know what mindfulness is. I do Vipassana courses. I'll be very mindful, madam." Okay, so off she went to the temple. She did some meditation, listened to a beautiful talk. And when she came back, she found her house had been ransacked. The thieves had been all over the place. She'd lost so much stuff. So she went out to see the guard. I said, "I thought you were going to be mindful." And the guard said, "Madam, I was mindful. I saw the thieves going in, and I noted thief going in, thief going in, thief going in. I noticed jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I noticed them back the truck to your house, truck going in, truck going in, truck going in. I noticed safe going out, safe going out. I was mindful all the time, madam." What would you do to such a stupid guard like that? The awareness wasn't enough. You always need that extra little thing, which is often I call kindness. And if we just had a little bit of kindness, then the guard would have called the police, or just, you know, made sure the houses were locked, or to do something to keep the burglars out. So being mindful doesn't just mean being aware of all stupid things going on. It's finding some ways of protecting your body and protecting your mind. So this is one of the reasons why, that to be able to be mindful of your back like that monk was, and be able to exercise those muscles in the back, solved the problem of having a sore back when he was sitting down. Brilliant solution. And that's one of the reasons why, that when we practice our mindfulness, soon it becomes strong enough, it gives us so many more options and ways of solving problems. So that's what we do when we start. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, how many steps are there in the Anapanasati Sutta? Great. Don't answer any of my questions, because they're always trick questions. There are 16 official steps, but the most important ones are just what you do before you even start the awareness of the breath, the preparations. And that main preparation is to make sure you establish mindfulness as a priority. Sometimes, this is one of our problems with when we quote the Buddha. Often, being in Australia, we quote the Buddha in the English language, it's translations. The Buddha never said that. The Buddha never said the Eightfold Path. He couldn't speak English. It was the Arya Mata. What did he say? Well, he said it in Pali anyway. So sometimes when we have translations, there's always a little bit lost in the translation. And the translation, the Anapanasati Sutta, usually started, you establish mindfulness in front of you. Have you ever read that translation? Totally inaccurate. But what does it mean, in front of you? In front of what? I was always taught there's no one in here as a Buddhist. In front of who? And anyway, just for ordinary people who don't know about anatta, just what does that actually mean? What do you understand by in front of you? For so many Westerners, we live here in our brain. And so in front of you means they usually think, well, in front of me, how can I watch my breath in front of my brain? So they start to watch it in front of their nose. It never says that. The breath meditation is a breath meditation. The Buddha never ever taught nose meditation. He never taught belly meditation. He taught breath meditation. And so we have to understand that what that word means, to establish mindfulness in front of you, means actually, the best translation I've ever come up with was make it a priority, make it first in the list, the top thing to look out for first of all, to make the mindfulness a priority. Once you have mindfulness strong enough, then of course it is easy to watch the breath. Many, many breaths in succession, you don't miss hardly anything. Why? Because you've developed the mindfulness first. And I mention this and I emphasize this. I don't stress this because we don't do stress in meditation. We just emphasize. It's the same word, we're just marketing. So we emphasize that establishing that mindfulness first of all before you start meditating. Because what happens if you don't do that? You get confused. You know, you say, I'm going to be mindful of the breath, and 1 minute later you're mindful of something else. You lost it. A lot of times people give up. They think, I can't meditate, it's too difficult. Or else they put forth effort. Right, I'm going to watch the breath. And then it's very unpleasant. So instead, we learn how to establish mindfulness to begin with, so that when it's the time, that we can see the breath very easily, and you're satisfied that you're peaceful enough to hold the breath without any effort. It's just there. You just watch it for an hour, everyone, no problem. Easy, because you've established the mindfulness first of all. That's one of the reasons why we asked you yesterday to be quiet, not to talk, to reduce the amount of talking, because then you will also reduce the amount of thinking. Because it's not just in the present moment you're mindful. In silence, it's so important to be mindful. You don't say breath going in, breath going out, because you're not watching the breath anymore. You're watching the words. You feel the breath going in. You feel the breath going out. You know it as it goes in and goes out. And then whenever you get to that type of meditation, when you are aware, without giving things names, it gets so much more interesting. You don't get bored. I know that people think I'm just making this up, but this is true. In all the time I've been alive, it's almost 72 years now, never once have I breathed in or breathed out two identical breaths. Every breath is totally unique. If you can see it clearly, of course you know it's unique. Every day is unique. There's never been a day like this ever before. Every breath is unique. Even though there's been millions of them, they're never the same. You can only notice that when you are really aware. Otherwise, all you ever know is in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. That's just a superficial mindfulness. When you're really mindful, you see just so much detail in the breath. Look at all these bricks in the wall. There's no two of these bricks are exactly the same. There's some which are similar, but they're not the same. Look at the wood on the floor there. They're all similar. There's no two pieces of wood the same. Look at each one of you. You're not girls and boys. Each one of you are totally different, unique. When that starts to happen, you know you've got mindfulness, you're seeing interesting things. Go onto the lawn around the stupas. See if you can find two identical blades of grass. There's thousands of blades of grass there, but there's no two the same. This is showing that your mind is becoming alert and can see deeply into things rather than superficial. A lot of times people are just lazy. Yeah, okay, I accept that every of these bamboo boards are in front of you which you're sitting on, no two are the same, but so what? What's the point of knowing that? All it is just it's seeing a truth, and often our brains just take the easy path, the shortcut, and just say it's wood, that's all. And don't look any deeper than that. I will come on to this again later on, but you know, the idea of mindfulness and stillness giving you insight. And what do I mean by that? Some years ago, when I was invited to give, I give so many talks in so many places, that when it's an interesting one, a weird one, that's the ones I usually accept. Because, you know, just giving a talk at a Buddhist center, I can do that here. Yeah, I do go overseas, but this was an invitation to the 2019 World Computer Conference in Daejeon in South Korea. And, I think all the monks over there, I can't see the last monk there. Oh, it is Venerable Patipada. But you all know, how good am I with computers? Be honest.
Decent.
You're being. It's only because I'm his teacher. He says such things. I would actually lower that sort of standard and say not decent. I struggle with computers. I'm old. But anyhow, they asked me to give the keynote address at the World Computer Conference in Daejeon. And when I got there, when we were just hanging around, getting to know one another before the conference started, so many of these people, these are really sort of high-tech people, it was the head of the European Union cybersecurity, as a genius, and all these other people from all these IT companies. And of course they asked me, so we haven't heard of you before, Ajahn Brahm. What company do you represent? The SWA. They said, well, what are you doing here? And that was the question they asked. What is a Buddhist monk doing at a World Computer Conference? It was Ajahn Sujato, maybe. You know, he deserved to be there. He knows a bit about computers, but me, nothing. So this is when I started saying about things like innovation. Instead of innovation, let's call it insight. I said, what is Buddhist innovation? And this is, I was just looking, I've had a water bottle, I've got a water bottle here. I used a plastic water bottle in Daejeon. This is one of the things which I did in my keynote address. And now I'm going to do it with you. You're allowed to speak in the next 5 minutes, okay? So don't just keep silent. What is this? Is that what it is? What else can you see? What else can you tell me about what I'm holding up? What else? What else?
Metal.
Yeah, what else? What else? Okay, now I think I'm going to make the point pretty quickly now because it's getting pretty heavy. When you first hold it up, you ask what it is, bottle of water. That's kind of correct, but it's not the full story, is it? And as human beings, you know, we have been trained, conditioned, that there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and you hold it up, what is it? Bottle of water, correct, well done. That's not the point of having insights or innovation. It's not just seeing what everyone else can see. See more of it. What actually is it? Yeah, but after a while, you forget answers. No such thing as a correct answer. You keep on looking, and the longer you look, the more you see. The deeper you see into it. This is actually like a proof, if you like. All those names give you the illusion you found the right answer. You don't have to look anymore. That stops insight. But if you just keep on looking, it's amazing, the longer you look, the more you see. And you can keep on doing that for hours. Our problem is, we think there's a right answer, wrong answer. When we get the right answer, we can stop. That's not about contemplation. If you do that, you find all the answers which come into your head, all the thoughts, what you've learned, what you've read in books, you know, what is the already known. If you keep on looking, you see things you've never seen before. That's where the contemplation really gets interesting. That's where insight happens. So this is one of the reasons why, just as the mindfulness increases, wow, it's amazing what you can see. Okay, this is one of those similes. Please excuse me if I keep on saying the same old similes which I said in the last retreat. But the reason I do this is because they are just the most evocative, the most meaningful, the most easy to explain, some of the deepest of teachings. And that was the first meditation retreat I went on. I was in university. We were allowed to go on a walk for 1 hour every morning before breakfast. And it was lovely to have that bit of exercise. And I used to choose to go to the botanical gardens, which were close by. And this was the university I was in, so I knew the place. But I thought I'd just have some exercise in the botanical gardens, but I never walked that far. I just got into the entrance. And at the entrance was a clump of bamboo, which was stunning. I'd never seen such a beautiful, incredibly detailed, amazing clump of bamboo ever before. And I was transfixed. And I had the awareness of what I was doing established enough. I had my mouth open. And it's a gorgeous clump of bamboo. What's that doing here? But I did notice that because in those times, you know, in a university, there's always many people on drugs. And if someone had seen me just with my mouth open, they may have called the white van and taken me away. You've got to be careful as Buddhists because we are weird sometimes. There was over in UK. These are funny stories. Over in UK, this is true stories, so don't make this up. Over in UK, there was a lady, she was just happened to be the senior psychiatrist at a mental institution in Sussex. So she was well known in the village, English village, everybody was curious, knew each other. But because she was a clinical psychiatrist, you know, head of a mental institution close by, that she had a big house. And because it was a big house, it had lots of bedrooms and a big, I think it was stables, which she cleaned up, and they had one of the first meditation retreats in UK there. And only a weekend retreat, had the space there. So this was one of those retreats. Everyone kept silent like you do. And when they did the walking, everyone had to wear white. You know, like the Anagarikas wear white, or Anagarikas wear white. And when it came to the walking meditation, the best place was in the garden. It was a nice sunny afternoon. So had all these people in white doing walking meditation in the garden, just lifting up their feet slowly, moving forward slowly, and then watching the transfer of the weight onto the other foot, and then again moving slowly forward. And in that village, there's always a few middle-aged ladies with nothing else to do but just to peer through the windows and see what the heck was going on. And so this lady, you can imagine it, never seen walking meditation before. All these people in white doing walking meditation in the home of a clinical psychiatrist who worked at the local mental institution. So she rang the police. And the police arrived to take all these meditators back to the institution and tell off the psychiatrist, you're not allowed to take them home with you on the weekend. It took a lot of explanation before he said, no, these are meditators. The police had never seen this before. And so they could manage to continue their retreat in that building instead of being taken back to the funny farm. But anyway, a similar thing happened here. People were doing the walking meditation, you know, nice and slowly outside. And there was a Sri Lankan family. Was it Sri Lankan? I don't know what, it doesn't really matter. But anyway, they asked, look, can we just go and have a look at your meditation retreat center? We won't make any noise. We just, you know, drive in slowly and just have a look. I said, yeah, why not? So they came in here, had a look. I was over at Jhana Grove. Someone else was teaching the retreat. And when they came back, they had like a 7-8-year-old kid, boy, and he insisted he had to see me. I said, why? What's up? Ajahn Brahm, you get to go over to your retreat centre right now. Why? What's gone wrong? It's been invaded by zombies. But apparently, zombies walk very slowly as well. And so they thought you were all zombies. Because all they saw was like people being really weird, not talking, keeping noble silence, and walking very, very slowly. So to this day, sometimes we joke that type of meditation is called zombie meditation, walking very, very slowly. Of course, it's not, but it's just how people observe it. Anyway, where did I get into this? That's right, the clump of bamboo. I realized that it was just standing there with my mouth open, not moving, just staring at a clump of bamboo. That wasn't a arrestable offense in those days. You get off, of course, but you take you to the police station first of all and do a test. So anyway, I sat down instead. There's a bench close by. But even so, just sitting down, I just watched that clump of bamboo for about 50 minutes, and I had to go back for breakfast. I was a young man. Breakfast was really important. But I could always come back the next day, which I did. 8 days of the 9 days, I sat down on that bench and just stared in awe at this clump of bamboo. I never finished with it. It was amazing. And, of course, I was just trying to find out what meditation was. There's no one to really explain what was happening. So I had to figure these things out by myself. And later on, now after the retreat had finished, and I went back to studies and social life, I had this free afternoon, and I thought, what am I going to do? I'll get on my bicycle and see the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world. And with all this anticipation, I got to the botanical gardens and went to that clump of bamboo, really excited to see it again. And as soon as I looked at it, the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world wasn't there anymore. Just was this desiccated, dry, it was very sick plant. Because look, you can't grow bamboo in a climate like UK. It's cold. Look, you know, bamboo is like Asian, it's Chinese. How many of you can survive without a hat and a coat and much else in England, especially in the cold weather? It's a stupid idea. That poor bamboo was like that. You felt like putting a scarf around it, a beanie on the top or something to keep it warm. That poor clump of bamboo was just so cold. But what struck me was I could not see the beauty anymore. It was just like a plant which shouldn't have been there, in the wrong place. And when I saw that, what really shocked me was, where did the beauty go? Or rather, where did the beauty come from? That beauty and their interest only came because I had a very still mind. And you could see more in that bamboo than anyone else could see. That's what I mean about, what is this? After a while, if you can honestly, not make it up, just look at a glass bottle for about an hour or two and not finish with it and see so much joy and beauty in there. Water is actually very beautiful. Just the way you get these lights reflected on the surface and around the edge. It's like a light show. I'm looking at it now and letting my mind play and explore it. It's actually the colours and the brilliance. It's really well balanced. Better put it down, otherwise that's the end of the talk. So this is actually what happens with insight, seeing things. You see it with much more clarity and joy and even like playfulness. Say playfulness, because you're exploring places you've never been before. That's one of the things which I was taught at Cambridge in the lab. You've got some equipment, play with it. They said, play with it. Because that's when you get to know it and you get to experiment with it and you feel confident with playing with the equipment before you even do some sort of experiment. You're seeing things which no one else has seen. And that's where you get the Nobel Prizes from. So if you think you know what you're doing, that's not exploring at all. You're not actually seeing new things. It's just old things. So anyway, that's when you're just watching your breathing. If you can watch a clump of bamboo for an hour every morning for 8 days without getting tired of it, of course you can just watch the breath come in, go out, go in, come out for such a long time. You never get exhausted by it. You just get fascinated by it. This is what mindfulness actually does. When mindfulness is really done properly, it grows naturally. You're just seeing much more. I never actually finished that metaphor of walking up the hill. Oh, I think I did that the first day, didn't I? No? I did, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a great simile, because you walk up the hill and you see so much more the slower you go, because your mind has got more time to get more information and to appreciate it much more. So all of these little similes, it's showing you that when you do build up mindfulness, which is one of the most important causes for deep meditation, if you get strong mindfulness, the meditation happens naturally, whether you like it or not. It's not a case that, oh, I'm a good meditator, I'm a hopeless meditator. It's just you get the causes in place, the right causes, the effects just happen. So when we get lots and lots of mindfulness coming up, that is a good sign that meditation is really going to take off. And how do we get that mindfulness coming up? Just again, being in this moment and just quietening the thinking mind. So we can be more still. When you're more still, you see more, you can appreciate it more truly, and it's much more fun. Even things I never ever thought would be fun, would be joyful, can be. Oh, I don't know. Honestly, I never plan these talks. But then you start and you explore and you keep going on in a particular way. And then these similes keep coming up. And excuse me again, but when I say you see some beauty in places you never expected to see beauty before, I cannot resist. I think you all know what's coming, or many of you do. If you don't, this is not made up. This happened. And the men's toilets opposite the laundry, in the middle cubicle, I'm going to put a sign up there like, you know, this is where this happened. You know, yeah, on a retreat, about 3 or 4 days into the retreat, yeah, I give talks, but I also meditate as well. So I think in the afternoon, after I finished a meditation in here, really nice and peaceful and beautiful. Oh, wow, it's nice. Then you went to the toilet to do a number two. And my mistake, if you have good meditation, please be wary of this. Don't look at what's in the bowl. Flush it first. Don't look. Because that was my mistake. I looked at the contents of the toilet bowl. Wow. Don't encourage me. In all my life, I've never seen such a beautiful piece of feces. Next time you go there, as long as there's no one waiting, because it takes a long time to finish with this, if you see it. You know, it's all these little balls put together, and it's like a sculpture. It's like it was done by, like it was done by some Michelangelo or by. Who's the other great sculptresses? And it was actually so, you know, you can go with size and shape. There has to be some balance in it, some way of actually making just ordinary stuff look incredibly beautiful, like it was made by some artistic professor or some famous genius. And that was just the shape of it. And of course, the next thing you look at is the colours. It's not a single colour, brown. It never is. There's always different shades. Now, if you look at the different shades and how they interact together, because no one colour can make the other colour stand out or make it sort of look more beautiful, and just the way all those colours are distributed onto this piece of feces. Wow. And I don't know, maybe I'm not quite sure if it was I had some sort of disease or something, but there was always some little, well, it was not called phlegm, but something on the outside which made it sparkle. What do you call that? Sorry?
Mucus,
yeah, a bit of mucus on there. And that in the lights of the toilet, that sort of reflected the lights, and it like sparkled, like the whole thing was impregnated with diamonds. And you looked at all this stuff, you know, for minutes, going, wow, wow, it's incredible. And then, of course, you went on to the aroma. Now, don't call it the stench. This was incredibly beautiful fragrance. Not like sort of the fragrance which people use when they put soap on their hands or when someone's just had a shower or they have perfume. This was real. This was spoke of real life, of the earth, you know, feces just come out fresh. I don't know why that when I use these words, people laugh, because you never had these words associated with a piece of shit ever before. But that's what it looked like, that's what it smelt like. And of course it was so hard for me to flush that little button and flush it away. And about two or three times, and I'm being honest, you felt like taking it out and showing it to people. Look at this. But I never did. It's because of the training I had in letting go and renouncing and giving up the most beautiful things you've ever seen in your life. It took a while though. Try to press the button, no, I can't. And then afterwards, no. Okay, press the button. And it went out of my life forever. But the memory was always there. The most beautiful thing I've ever laid. Now that's fun to hear, even if you've heard it about 100 times before. But it's also the insight you get from that, the message. Why do I say such stuff? If you can see such beauty, and honest, incredible beauty, in a piece of things which people will be disgusted in, how much easier is it to see your breath? Seeing your breath looks, wow, absolutely delightful. Because when it starts to look delightful, that is when the meditation takes off. I say many of these similes, but it was one of the monks reminded me that years and years ago, I'd always say that once you can start to see the delightful breath, I used to call it the beautiful breath before. Once you can be aware of the delightful breath or beautiful breath, that's like a pivot point in meditation. Once that happens, then you're away. Because you can't take your eyes off the breath. It's just so gorgeous. That's one of the reasons over here, if ever you do look in the toilet bowl, please don't do that, because if after deep meditation you'll have the same experience. You know, what you thought would never be beautiful is incredibly beautiful. What that happens is that so many other people will be queuing outside. Like, come on! And there's somebody in the toilet going, wow, wow, wow. You have to wait to go in. So don't do that here. But nevertheless, just when that starts to happen, you can't take your eyes off the object. Your mindfulness is with your breath. It doesn't want to go anywhere. All that effort, struggle, striving, trying to watch the breath. You have to really put forth effort not to watch the breath, to drag yourself away from it. It's just gorgeous. And so once you get to that stage of meditation, just keep on meditating. that joy gets greater and greater and greater and greater and greater and greater. It blows you away how much joy is there. And I know that sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, here you go off again talking about these bliss states. And I just go to sleep when I meditate, or I just start thinking about all sorts of crazy stuff. That's okay. Because one day when you get to that pivot point, and you're watching the breath, and it actually does look beautiful, looks gorgeous, stay there. Don't get afraid. You're out of control. That's what's supposed to happen. You're disappearing. Bye-bye me. Bye-bye Ajahn Brahm. And you have a wonderful time. Very peaceful, very beautiful. It doesn't just stop with a delightful breath. It goes way deeper. You get to things like the nimittas. Oh my goodness. Are you sure you set the clock right? It says 56 here. Can't be that late. I spent too much time on that bit of feces. But you get these beautiful lights in the mind. And they're weird, because it's the colours you've never seen before. You know, yellows and blues. Blues like real pure blue. Not like these ordinary blues you see in paintings. Real blue. The yellows. The golds. More gold than gold. And you're doing that. You're actually seeing it. You're not imagining it. It's your own experience. And that kind of blows you away. This is something which ordinary people just can't see. Unless you're experiencing that. This is what happens. When it does happen, that will make this retreat really worthwhile. If that starts happening before lunch, bye-bye lunch. Of course you're not interested in the lunch when you have that sort of happiness and interest coming on. You're understanding also the power of your mind. Just when it's allowed to be rested and still. How do you get your body to recover from illness? A lot of times by resting. That's why people go to hospitals. When you go to hospitals, they don't get you working in a hospital. They put you in a bed and keep you there. How do you get enlightened? I try and put your mind in a hospital bed and lock you down and keep you there. If there were straitjackets for the mind, I'd give each one of you one so you can't think. You have to just be here. So you can't wander off anywhere. Lock you in a little room in the deep meditations. You're enjoying yourself immensely. And that's how the meditation works. And every one of you can do that. That's the incredible thing. When you teach meditation, you look at people. I know some of you for a long time, know some of you for a short time. And you just look at some of you and think, just him, her, no way. No way they can get any deep meditation. And then they come and surprise you. I say, hey, Brahma, I was just meditating. So this beautiful light came in my mind. It was gorgeous. Yeah. Honestly, I cannot predict which one of you gets these incredibly deep meditations. My job is just to try and get rid of all the obstacles for you. So you put the conditions in, you have pretty much good health, comfort of the body, and just go for it and see what happens. Don't try and aspire to it. Don't want it. Don't strive for it. You know that, what strive for it does? It just makes the water move more. Leave it alone. Your job is just to observe, to be mindful, to be kind, and do absolutely nothing. Did anyone ever tell you you were lazy? If they did, you're a very good candidate for deep meditation. Did anyone tell you you're just a control freak? And if they told you that, you've got a lot of work to do. Actually, you've got a lot of work not to do. In other words, relax to the max. That's one of those other little phrases I use. And people think, like many of the stuff which I say, it's just a joke. That is not a joke. And now, what was the Buddha's last words of advice before he passed away? What do you think my last words will be when I pass away? Relax to the max. That's what I would say. It's powerful. Honestly, are you relaxed? Really relaxed to the max? Give it a try. You're sitting here, relax, get yourself nice and comfortable. Ah, feels good. This is one of the most relaxing postures you can be in. You lie back in your bed and you're always tossing and turning. You're sitting meditation, you can sit sometimes like this for hours. Relax to the max. You don't hold the body feels good like this. It likes being here. And then relax the mind. My mind likes being in the present moment. It likes being still. It likes being silent. That's my trouble. Every time I mention the word silence and I mean it, I just don't want to do anything more. Silence actually beckons you. And just you want to enter it and just be quiet. And all these words, they're only there to lead to the silence. They cannot explain it. So anyway, that's the talk for this morning. I hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't yet, you soon will. Just enjoy the whole place no matter what happens. Because you can, your body and mind get so relaxed, it really increases in its power. And even the lunch, wow. You never had such beautiful food before, wow. It's a really good deal, this place. 5-star restaurant, 5-star meditation, and 5-star toilets. Okay, thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So whatever you want to do now. Usually in the mornings we have interviews, but not today. I never do the interviews the first day. The reason for that is there's not much to interview you about. You're just starting off. Okay? But if you have any questions, piece of paper outside, we'll answer those questions this afternoon. Oh, this evening. Is that correct?